Tonight on the Daily Debrief, the death of a 10-year-old Georgia girl.
She was extremely thin and emaciated.
Authorities say this stepmother starved her, but that's just one version of the story.
I did not feel as though Iman was being honest with me.
Now, the defendant asks for a last-minute private meeting with the judge. Plus,
following a vehicle around isn't going to tell me if prostitution occurred inside of a business.
Police defend their use of hidden cameras inside a massage parlor, which they say caught an NFL owner with a prostitute. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Friday, April 26.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Michael Bochner, Imran Ansari here along with me. Michael Bryant will be with us in just a moment. A Georgia woman will not testify in her own defense on charges she starved her own stepdaughter to death. This after she defended herself without a lawyer through the entire case. Tiffany Moss refused to give an opening statement and refused to cross-examine witnesses on charges she killed 10-year-old Imani Moss. She's even facing the death penalty. The girl's father testified that the defendant called him to report the girl was injured and then later reported the girl died. This defendant is accused of doing nothing because she was paranoid about violating her parole. After testimony about text messages between the defendant and her husband, and after a police officer testified about a number of other photos taken at the scene, we heard this testimony that the suspected husband or that police rather suspected the husband of lying about exactly what happened.
During the first portion of the interview, I did not feel as though Iman was being honest with me.
Okay. Did you confront him about that?
I did multiple times. His initial statements were sort of all over the place. They were sporadic and they weren't making typically a person who is telling a story will do so in chronological order. He was jumping all over the place in his retelling of the story initially. That's a clear indicator of deception. And so I routinely asked him, Iman, let's start over. This does not seem right. You're all over the place. So we had him go back multiple times and restart the interview.
With regard to that, did you ever ask him if he was covering for anyone?
I did.
Did he give you a response to that?
Yes.
Who did he say he was covering for?
He told me multiple times throughout that first portion of the interview that he was trying to cover for Tiffany.
Was he the only one responsible for putting her into the trash can?
No.
Who else was responsible for putting her in the trash can?
Iman told me that he and Tiffany had both placed the body into the trash can. Prior to placing it into the trash can, the body had gone into rigor mortis. It was stiff, and he informed me that they had to break the body down and use duct tape to duct tape the body in order to make it fit into the trash can.
Was that a two-person job then?
Absolutely.
Was there going to be an explanation for why or where Imani was?
Yes. He informed me that the plan was to list Imani as a runaway child and call the police later to list her as a runaway and that no one would ever find her.
The medical examiner who examined the victim's body found evidence of a partially healed stomach wound. The husband talked about that yesterday. The medical examiner also found evidence of burning. The husband admitted to that yesterday. But the cause of death, officially, is starvation.
She was extremely thin and emaciated. She had a starved look, and based on her weight and loss of muscle mass and the fact that her organs were so small, compared to the normal charts, I was able to conclude from that she had died from starvation. You ruled this starvation. In your opinion, do you know and can you describe for the jury kind of the order or what would happen when somebody is being starved?
Well, the first thing that would happen in the early stages, they would experience hunger pangs. She would probably feel hungry. She would be asking for food, looking for food, craving food. Following that, the next step would be apathy,
fatigue, not able to do her usual activities. And from there, she would become more and more listless, eventually lethargic, and mental status changes. She would not feel like moving around much. She wouldn't have much energy. There would be extreme weight loss that would be visible. And then finally, death.
Today, the defendant representing herself asked to meet with the judge privately. It's called an ex parte hearing, and the judge was reluctant to grant it. The prosecutor objected. Defendant Tiffany Moss's standby attorneys jumped in on the argument.
Is there something you need from the court that you don't have?
It would be something that I would need later. And we're bringing it up.
Okay. Can you tell me anything else without sort of letting the cat out of the bag?
Not really, Your Honor.
Defense counsel makes the request, and we're not talking about standby. Defense counsel makes a request to the court. The court looks at the request, determines whether it's appropriate or not, and then rules as to whether ex parte is necessary. In Putnell, the court decided that I'm going to give this over to the state so that they can see. And that was the improper thing. And that got the whole thing reversed because the court didn't make the determination. The court is in the position of making the determination whether it is appropriate or not, not the state. And placing the defendant in the position of divulging what is trying to get the court's attention in front of the state before the court makes a decision as to whether it is appropriate or not is clearly improper under Putnam.
Right. I'm not asking her to divulge anything. In fact, I said just the opposite.
She did the best that she could, Your Honor, and you asked her for more information.
The state would be willing.
The state said it would only be okay with the judge looking at a request for a private hearing in writing. Ultimately, the judge did hold the hearing, but said he would take no action on the merits. Yesterday, in this case, the state's key witness, the girl's father, the defendant's husband, took the stand. That man, Amon Moss, said he noticed belt whips on his daughter after this defendant punished the daughter. State intervention helped for a little while, but it did not save the girl's life. According to the father, the defendant said Imani died because of a cooking accident.
Said she was cooking something with a pot and she spilled the water on her stomach.
That Imani was cooking?
Imani, yeah. Tiffany said Imani was cooking.
And that she spilled a pot?
Yeah.
Did Tiffany tell you what was in the pot?
No, said hot water.
So you went, when you went home, did you look at your daughter? And
yeah.
What did you see?
She had a skull on the stomach, like a round little skull part on the stomach.
And
on her?
Did you say we ought to take her to the doctor?
Yeah, but I didn't do it.
So on the 24th, you found her in the bathtub, and did it look to you like Imani was having a seizure?
Best of my knowledge, yes.
I know you're not a doctor, yeah. But what did she look like?
She was shaking, like, you know.
Could she speak?
She was trying to say something. She wasn't speaking much. She was, you know.
Were her eyes moving at all?
They were going from left to right.
So after Tiffany said we can't call the doctor, we can't take her to the hospital, what'd you do with her?
Kept her in the room.
In which room?
In her room.
I mean, did you put her on the floor or where did you put her?
On a mattress. And on the floor.
Amon, did she ever get up out of that bed?
No, she didn't after the seizure thing. No, she didn't.
No one called for a doctor. The father says it was all to protect the defendant who was already on probation. Ultimately, Imani died, and the two hatched a plan to hide the body. Here's part of that process, according to the father.
I'm not familiar with rigor mortis, but it done set in. And it was hard to bend the body, and that's where the duct tape came in, involved in. And at that time, Tiffany's in there in the bedroom with me, helping me do this.
So when you don't have to be familiar with rigor mortis.
Okay.
Did you have to force her legs to fold?
Yes, sir.
And did you and Tiffany do that together?
Yes, sir.
Did you have to sort of force her arms down by her side?
Yes, sir.
And did you and Tiffany do that together?
Yes, sir.
It seems like it would be difficult for one person to wrap duct tape around the little girl's body. How did that happen?
That is very difficult.
Did Tiffany help you with that?
Yes, she did.
Amon, your daughter's been dead for 3 days now. How difficult was it to get her folded up like that?
Very, very much difficult.
Were there sounds?
Kind of like, I guess, like cracking sound. I can't explain. I don't know what to compare it to, what I'm saying.
And after you got her duct taped together, what happened then?
After that, she helps me, you know, because she's a lot more heavier than she was before. To put the, you know, put her in the lawn bag.
This father admitted he drove around with his dead daughter's body in his car. Who else was in the car? His wife, the defendant, and her own two kids. He said the defendant wanted to bury Amani's body, but that it was his idea to burn it.
I lifted the trash can out. I opened the bag of charcoal and poured it in the tin can. The trash can, the tin can. And from that point, she helped me open the bag up where, you know, my body, you know, wrapped up in duct tape. She helped me put her body in the tin can.
Did you put her head up or head down?
Head up.
Did you have to force her into it?
Kind of, yeah.
After you put Amani in that garbage can, what did you do then?
I sprinkled some lighter fluid on the body and on charcoal.
Then what?
And then, I took a charcoal and I lighted it on fire and I dropped it in the tin can.
So did it start to burn?
It started to flame real big.
So what were you doing at that point?
I was standing out, and, you know, I was standing, she was out there with me.
I mean, did y'all watching. Say anything, or would you just stand and watch the fire?
As I did it, I turned my back, and I didn't watch it, and she said, I can't watch this. And it just burned.
How long did you let it burn?
Not that long. I want to say I let it burn for about like maybe 5 minutes, and I put it out.
Why?
Because it wasn't working in the way I thought it was supposed to work.
And what did you think was going to happen?
I know this sounds ridiculous. You know, I'm thinking it's like cremation. I don't know anything about that.
From there, the father smothered the fire and took what was left of his daughter's body to a trash compactor. Joining me tonight here on The Debrief, Michael Bochner, Imran Ansari, and Michael Bryan, all attorneys. Good to see you, gentlemen. Michael Bochner, first question for you. Ex parte proceedings here generally disallowed, but in Georgia, they have an exception that says a defendant representing herself can ask for one if there are issues or roadblocks involving her defense. So I'm really curious what went on back there in judges' chambers.
Well, the judge didn't think too much went on there because whatever relief was requested was denied. It didn't do very much about it. Ex parte applications are generally not looked upon favorably regardless. There's this theory that both sides should know what the other side is doing. However, you can make a written application to the court if you have something that's interesting and say, Judge, I need some private time with you, and the court will decide, but that didn't happen.
There's case law on this, thanks to Linda Kenny Budden. She dug it up. I have to read it all. I'm very curious. Imran Ansari, though, multiple stories about this death. The father says the defendant said it was a cooking accident, and then later told police that this little girl drank some kind of chemical or something like that. So then he told that story to police. Okay, he's got a different story on the stand. The medical examiner says that she starved. She was in the fifth percentile. She was tiny. Seems to me an attorney like you would be pushing this as some more possible reasonable doubt in here as to whether or not there's a nexus between the death and this particular defendant.
Actually, Aaron, I think the evidence is pretty damning. You have a child who's been horrifically neglected to the point where she passes away from starvation. It's a horrific set of facts. I think that, you know, what do you do with this sort of case? The forensic evidence shows that she was starved. And then you have these multiple sort of stories from the husband here, and it doesn't add up. So I really feel that it's horrific. The evidence is stacked against the defendant, and what are you going to do?
Certainly, okay, it's a tough case for the defendant, but any defense, it seems, would be better than no defense. I don't know, though. Michael Bryant, we're hearing that there may be some mental health issues behind this, possible brain damage. That could come and play a big part of this on appeal.
There's no doubt. In fact, I think the biggest opponent of the prosecution is the appellate court. It's not what's happening in this court, Aaron.
Michael Bryant, all right, we're going to check in with all three of you guys again at the end of the broadcast here. Because still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, an update on the case of a man accused of killing a California family of four. Plus, the owner of the New England Patriots wants evidence in his prostitution case tossed out of court. A lengthy hearing on that matter started today. We'll head back inside the courtroom for that after the break. Testimony is on hold until next week in the McStay family murder case from California due to matters affecting an attorney's health. Defendant Charles Merritt is accused of killing business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family. They all disappeared in 2010, but it wasn't until years later when the graves of all four of the McStays turned up in the Mojave Desert. Attorneys for the owner of the New England Patriots were in court today trying to get evidence in his case thrown out. The purpose of the so-called suppression hearing was to determine if hidden cameras installed pursuant to a warrant were actually constitutional. The defense argued that the police didn't have enough evidence to call a fake bomb scare in order to install their hidden cameras. The defense also said it was unfair for police to charge some people but not certain informants.
Basically what happens is they get a massage, they flip over, they received genital manipulation, I think, as you put it. They were cleaned off, right, towel again, and they tipped, or they didn't, and they left.
Correct.
That's the gist.
Yes.
Those individuals, which I think are sort of subject A to D, right, we can call them?
Yes, sir.
They're never charged?
They are not, no.
Okay. And you don't... That happens in prostitution investigations where people are stopped and never charged, right?
That happens in all kinds of investigations, yes.
Well, I mean, I think you would agree with me that if it's a murder investigation and somebody murders somebody, you don't stop and go, you know what, thanks for the information, take off, right?
That would be correct.
Okay, but in an investigation like this, right, where the most egregious thing that the person you stopped did was what occurred inside of the massage, you have the discretion to let them go.
That's correct.
And you exercise that discretion.
Yes.
And that happens all the time in the state of Florida.
Yes.
So they become, in your mind, confidential informants in that moment, colloquially at least?
Yes, sir.
And, I mean, did you consider charging them, making them go to court, and then sort of flipping them and saying, you know, now that we have you, I'm going to, you know, videotape your statement. I'm going to get more out of you. Did you consider that or no?
We were on the side of the road, and I made it very clear to them that my intention was to use their information to assist me in putting an end to an illicit massage business that was operating within this strip mall.
The issue here is whether the state really needed cameras present in that massage parlor in order to prove illegal conduct. The lead investigator said yes, absolutely, despite constitutional privacy concerns.
Following a vehicle around isn't going to tell me if prostitution occurred inside of a business. In order for me to do that, I would have to visually observe prostitution occurring. Therefore, I believed, and the court agreed with me, that I needed to have cameras inside the business so I could affirmatively say that prostitution was occurring inside that business and that that business was in fact what I believed it to be, which was an illicit massage business. It was a criminal enterprise. It was acting solely deriving the support of that business from the guise of a massage establishment, and it only received its money from illicit activity.
The defense also argued that hidden cameras caught video of people receiving massages who were completely innocent. Back to the panel for some analysis here. Michael Bryant, we'll go to you first here. Okay, so should this be suppressed or should this recording come into this case?
You know, I think the best argument for suppression is really the basis for the warrant in the first place. One of the things put in the warrant was this belief there was some human trafficking. And that really got the attention of the public when hearing about it. And I think it made this case a bigger case and made it seem more like, okay, hidden camera might be justified. Well, we now know that was nothing. That was a red herring at best. So it makes the argument by the prosecution a little flimsier that they must have had this hidden camera video to get what they needed. I think the defense has a shot to keep this thing out.
Okay, they've got a shot here, but Michael Bochner, okay, so we have police saying they did some scoping, they did some internet searches, they thought something weird was going on here. Then they collected the garbage. They can do that without a warrant. And the garbage had, shall we say, private fluids in it. So then they're just like, okay, what exactly is going on here? Then they go get the warrant. It seems to me like this warrant was decent. This was probably good. That's just my take. What do you think?
Look, I think that there was probably a good reason to get this warrant. And at the end of the day, what we have here is there's a good faith exception to the Fourth Amendment, basically meaning that even if there wasn't probable cause, if the magistrate signed it in good faith and the cops believed in it in good faith, it still doesn't get thrown out. So I think the defense has a very, very tough argument here regardless.
This recording comes in. Of course, that's going to make the whole case. It's a big piece of it. The defense doesn't want anybody to see it. Imran Ansari, I wish we could talk about that, but we're out of time. I'll ask you that one next time, Imran.
All right, okay, sounds good.
Great panel tonight. Thanks for watching The Debrief. For those of you watching along at home, we'll be back here Monday at 5 p.m.